Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, April 10th, and I'm Ohelia Holland, youth and journalism intern, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt Soups updated on culture change initiative. Fort Bragg code enforcement exploring methods to keep track of vacant buildings. And Mendocino County updates sea level rise planning. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. A Humboldt County workplace improvement effort is proving useful as budget stresses intensify. Daniel Mintz reports.
A comprehensive organization development and culture change initiative is coming in handy as Humboldt County government struggles with budget impacts. Launched in 2020, the county's Great Workplace Culture Change Initiative sought to improve workplace conditions and working relationships and encourage inclusion. It's morphed into Workplace 2030, a long-range workplace and employee morale improvement effort. The initiative's progress was detailed in a presentation at the March 26th Board of Supervisors meeting. Workplace 2030 is a government-wide effort with multiple departments participating. Numerous committees, including staffing and professional development, diversity, equity, and inclusion, teamwork and collaboration, and management and leadership, are working on analyzing and addressing workplace-related issues. And Supervisor Steve Madrone said the initiative is aptly timed.
As you all know, we have real serious budget issues happening in the county, not only this year, but over the next few years. And certainly one of the best ways to handle that is to increase employee morale and communication and onboarding and succession planning. All of these things is an investment well worth whatever effort it takes. And I think you'll find this board's very supportive of the work you've done. And now the real work begins to try and implement, not try, but to implement all of this work. So I want to thank you for that because, you know, we're looking at reorganization work. We're looking at all kinds of different things. But again, when we improve the employee's ability to be able to perform, we increase that morale. People get up in the morning going, I'm going to work. Like you said, I want to work for the county.
Supervisor Natalie Arroyo said, quote, this work will be more important than ever in the next few years as we're addressing challenges around resources that are pretty significant. End quote. We will utilize this very much. The degree of trust between employees and department managers is a high-profile issue discussed in this exchange between Supervisor Michelle Bushnell and Lucinda Jackson of the Management and Leadership Committee.
The lack of trust is something we hear a lot throughout the organization, and so I would be interested to hear more of where it stems from and what people think the solutions are. I saw a little bit of what you guys referenced to, but that trust is really a key thing, and it seems to be overarching in the conversation, in every conversation when we talk about departments and boards and so forth and so on. So I am curious there. But I do really appreciate the presentation and the work that you've done in this.
The management and leadership team, as part of our deep dive into the root causes of the issues, we actually have a document that will summarize key factors that contributed to trust issues. So I'd be happy to share that.
The trust factor was further discussed in this exchange between Supervisor Mike Wilson and Jackson.
Was the feeling of not feeling trusted as employees, or is it the feeling of trust within the hierarchy of the organization between employees and supervisors?
It's both, okay. And it's across pretty consistently all departments that we were able to identify.
Okay.
Employees don't feel empowered or trusted to do the work that they've been hired to do, mm-hmm. or equipped to do it, and employees feel that their leadership isn't trustworthy.
Okay.
And that'll be kind of outlined in that second document that I mentioned. When we took a pretty deep dive, we identified problem statements And we really wanted to understand what the root causes behind problems raised by employees. So that way we could really identify, is this just a feeling? Is this an isolated incident? Or is this a common thread that needs to be identified for what it is and addressed? And we found that there were a lot of leanings towards it's a pretty consistent problem that needs to be addressed.
The initiative committees have identified top-ranking problems and issues and ways to address them. Things being done include identifying issues through surveys, giving new employees more thorough workplace introductions, recognizing employees' work efforts, and developing teamwork. One of the initiative's leaders, Dr. Jeremy Clark, credited the Board of Supervisors with having open ears. He said the initiative's committees have, quote, outlined a litany of problems that our organization faces, and I really appreciate that your board never shies away from hearing those difficult words. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
A pit bull reportedly attacked its owner. Lauren Schmidt provides further details.
In Eureka, last night, local police were called to a distressing scene on Glen Street just after 9 p.m. A person was reportedly attacked by their own dog, prompting an urgent response from the Eureka Police Department. Upon arriving, officers found the victim inside their home, too frightened to leave due to the aggressive dog. In a bid to rescue the victim, police used pepper spray to deter the animal, enabling the person to safely exit the home. A child, also found in the home, was removed through a bedroom window, thankfully unharmed. The incident began when the victim attempted to prevent one of three dogs, a gray pit bull, from mating. The intervention led to a severe and serious attack. Although the other two dogs did not physically assault the victim, their behavior was described as aggressive by police. Emergency services quickly transported the victim to a local hospital for treatment. To ensure public safety, the dogs were contained within the home until a family member and officers could securely transport the offending dog to the Humboldt County Animal Shelter. The Eureka Police Department says the investigation continues and is now being led by their animal control officer. KMA News reached out to EPD for further comment. However, they have yet to return our inquiry as of news time.
Local gun shops partner with DHHS in Striving for Zero Suicide Prevention Initiative. Lauren Schmidt reports.
The following story discusses suicide and self-harm and may not be suitable for all of our listenership. The Striving for Zero Suicide Prevention Strategic Planning Learning Collaborative marks a significant step forward in California's efforts to combat suicide. Launched in February 2021 by the state's Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission, the initiative aligns with the strategic aims and objectives of California's Striving for Zero, a suicide prevention plan that seeks to integrate comprehensive strategies and innovative solutions to address the pressing public health issue. California's strategic plan for suicide prevention was adopted in November 2019 and emphasized the importance of reducing access to lethal means as a universal prevention strategy. Evidence suggests that restricting access to methods of suicide significantly decreases suicide rates. Locally, Humboldt County's Public Health Branch received state recognition and was recently honored with the Striving for Zero Suicide Prevention Excellence Award. This accolade celebrates their collaboration with local firearm retailers to enhance safety and prevent suicide through the distribution of informational resources and free lockboxes as part of the Keep It Safe campaign. Recent statistics from the California Violent Death Reporting System have unveiled a troubling trend that underscores the urgency of addressing mental health and suicide prevention. In 2020 alone, California recorded a total of 4,143 suicides, with an alarming increase observed in cases involving firearms. Specifically, firearms were the method of suicide in 43% of male victims, highlighting a critical area for intervention. In Humboldt County, the situation is particularly dire. Over the span of roughly a decade, the county witnessed 528 suicides, with nearly half of these tragic events involving a firearm. This has positioned firearm-related suicides as a significant public health concern within the community. More striking is the Humboldt County suicide mortality rate, which currently stands at 23%, a rate more than double the state average, indicating a critical need for targeted suicide prevention efforts in the region. The Gunshot Project, a cornerstone of the DHHS strategy, involves local firearm dealers and ranges in suicide prevention efforts. By incorporating education on lethal means safety into firearm training and permit courses, the project aims to bridge the gap between firearm culture and suicide prevention. NKMA News reached out to one of the partners in their campaign.
So my name is Jared Waddle, born and raised here in Humboldt County. Always loved firearms and kind of lived that lifestyle and then found my way into a career.
Waddle is the co-owner of Ballistic Precision, a shooting range in Eureka.
DHHS had contacted us. They, I believe, had gotten some grant money, and we're starting a program for what they called Keep It Safe, and that was to educate and provide not only lockboxes, safes, but also just literature and advice, and what evolved into actually some classroom type stuff for people to be educated on, you know, not just firearm safety, but, you know, medication overdose safety, suicide prevention, as well as, you know, violence prevention. And it's been a good program, and I think they've been successful.
While firearm owners are not inherently at greater risk of suicide, the risk of death increases when someone who is experiencing a suicide crisis has easy access to a gun.
The big thing is it's not necessarily firearm owners who are at the greater risk of potential suicide urges or violence. Generally, it's someone who knows that someone has a firearm available in their house, whether it's another family member that doesn't own the gun but knows there's one there, children. I mean, there's so many different risk factors, people with, you know, chronic pain, substance abuse. This program kind of spearheaded during the pandemic, and we knew a lot of people were kind of locked up and just experienced a lot of different stress and things like that.
Most recently, the SVP has been working with local firearm instructors to develop a one-hour mental health curriculum to meet new state requirements for CCW training.
Yeah, so they've implemented a couple classes, and I know one instructor that uses our facility, she's been getting more people familiarized with the inherent risks of, you know, not having firearms locked up or easy access to them. We've actually added some curriculum into our training courses, whether it's just an introduction to firearms, basic class. You know, we have a portion in there on suicide prevention, lethal means safety as well in there. And that's, it's informative and it's good stuff to know because it's out there. A lot of people don't know how often, you know, unfortunately, suicides happen by firearms and violence. But it's around. And if you've ever read the news, Humboldt County does have a higher suicide rate than many other places. So I feel this program, you know, it helps. I think it does.
In a time of deep division over gun control debates, collaboration on practical life-saving solutions is a beacon of progress, says the project partner, highlighting the importance of collaborating in addressing complex issues like suicide prevention.
I think it's really good. And I'm really, really glad that they were recognized on the state level of the program that they created. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what political background you have, what your gun rights are, whatever. Not everybody, but lots of people have firearms. It doesn't matter what you are. They're a tool. Some people hate them. Some people like them. But at the end of the day, having a program like this, that's like, hey, this is for everybody. Let's get these lockboxes out there. Let's educate people. Let's make sure we're locking our stuff up. We're keeping things safe. It's good program, and I think they're going to keep going forward with it. And we still have a bunch at our location that we're giving out.
Free lockboxes are also available at the Public Health Community Wellness Center, located at 908 7th Street in Eureka. If you have questions about obtaining a lockbox or cannot make an in-person visit, you can email keepitsafe@co.humboldt.ca.us or call the Healthy Communities Division at 707-268-2132. You can also reach out to Ballistic Precision for other gun safety questions.
Yeah, they're always welcome to contact us. We really enjoy people coming down. The shooting range has been great. You know, we've only been open for 4 years. But as far as, you know, myself, I've been in the firearms industry working in it for close to 16 years now. And really, we like talking to people and, you know, educating them on firearms, firearm safety. There's so many questions out there, and we have no problem talking to people and helping them out.
If you're interested in getting involved in suicide prevention efforts locally, the Humboldt County Suicide Prevention Network meets bi-monthly. They are also seeking members of the community to join their Lethal Means Safety Subcommittee. To join, you can email humboldtspn@gmail.com for more information. If you are concerned for yourself or someone you know, please know you are not alone. And help is available 24/7. Just dial 988. Or you can contact the crisis text line by texting HOME to 741-741.
Turning to Mendocino. Fort Bragg Code Enforcement exploring methods to keep track of vacant buildings. Sarah Reith reports.
Fort Bragg is in the initial phase of trying to get absentee property owners to take care of properties that are vacant most of the year, or for years on end. But a recent proposal by code enforcement to require a registry of vacant properties did not meet the approval of community members or the city council committee tasked with bringing a more fleshed-out proposal before the full council. Valerie Stump of the city's code enforcement department said she thought a registry of vacant properties would establish a point of contact for the city to get in touch with out-of-town or corporate property owners when something needs to be addressed.
I am seeing quite a few residential where it's not corporate owned, but it is owned by someone who doesn't live locally. And so that becomes another issue where I'm trying to contact this person because maybe it's fire season, they need to cut down their, you know, sky high grass, and I use whatever addressing or information we have on file for them through the utility account and through the county assessor's office, and they haven't updated it with either of them. So then I'm doing this whole tracking game where I'm going on the internet sleuthing, trying to figure out how to identify this person and where they live now. And it's happened quite a few times over the last 3 years that I've worked for the city. So I think that having this registration for out-of-towners and corporate owners where it's a direct person I can contact when there's an issue.
Stump said initial research showed that approximately 200 properties within city limits are vacant. Proposed registration fees ranged from $90 to $127 a year, depending on what kind of property it was. Mayor Bernie Norvell, who owns rental properties, proposed a scenario.
Let's say I have a rental and I get somebody who's delinquent in rent, so I give them a 3-day pay or quit. They don't. Then I have to go to court and they get notice. So they vacate the property, but I'm still not allowed on the property because I haven't taken ownership of it back. That process can be 45, 50 days. And then I need to go in and maybe spend 3 weeks, after work in the evenings, tearing out carpet, repainting, repairing all of the damage. So now we're at 80 days. And then I have to list the rental, right? I mean, I don't know, I could put somebody in there the next day, but it's not necessarily going to be the right person. So it could take me, say, 2 weeks to find a proper tenant. And that tenant's going to move there from another place and they have to give 30 days, you know, so now we're at 90 or 100 days. Am I going to be required to register that property as a vacant property?
Stump suggested waivers for properties that are vacant for a reason. But during public comment, Jenny Shattuck invoked the fear of lethal control on the part of officialdom as she made her point that it isn't any of the city's business why someone might not be on site.
From experience, I know that I had a child born with cancer and I had to go live in the Bay Area in a hospital for 3 years. I couldn't imagine having to pay a fee and have to prove to you guys and explain my son's medical condition. I mean, I could have, endometriosis and have to be gone for a while. I should not have to explain my medical situation to the city and have them review it for a waiver. If you want to go after properties that are derelict, go after properties that are derelict. This is not Nazi Germany where we have to have a list of people.
Many property owners who can afford to own a home in Fort Bragg have to work elsewhere in order to support their ownership. The committee members, Norvell and Vice Mayor Jason Godek, agreed that the proposal needs further refinement. Godek wants a more developed ordinance that specifically addresses nuisances and unused commercial properties.
We're really interested in these properties that are essentially a nuisance. They're derelict, they're not being kept up. But I do feel like the ordinance is expressed here as far as the vacant property registry is, it becomes so far-reaching. It just makes a bunch of lawbreakers out of people who are, you know, potentially taking good care of their properties and may have, as we just heard, may have a million reasons why they might not be there for a few months. And so that really is my concern. And I also am concerned about the fact that it doesn't even address the vacant storefronts.
Paul Clark, a local property manager, owns an empty lot that gets used intermittently.
We mow it. You see a big white tent up there every year. It's a Pentecost hall, uses it for overflow parking and everything else. Do you think I'm going to be real cheerful when I have to write out a check for $97 and register it? Tell me if I comply or not. Is it one that I have to do it? It's a vacant lot. Is it developed? It's got a fence. It's got a well. What is an undeveloped parcel? That was some of the questions I had.
Stump contended that it's important to keep track of nuisance properties with out-of-town owners.
I do see the value in having the registration. I can understand your hesitation, though, on us not having it as defined as we should. I also just want to say, too, that these nuisance properties where it has been an absentee property owner and no one's living there, it takes years. It takes years for us to actually get them into compliance. These property owners leave it vacant, and then every year we're contacting them with the same problems, and the house itself is just deteriorating over and over and over again. So I do see the value in the registration.
The committee agreed that more detail is needed, especially in defining vacancy and the precise conditions that would trigger the requirement for a property to be registered. Stump took the directions to refine the ordinance, which includes cost recovery plans for nuisance compliance fees. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Reif. For all our local news, with photos and more, visit kzyx.org.
Mendocino County and Fort Bragg updates sea level rising planning. Michelle Blockwell reports.
In May of last year, Mendocino County and the coastal cities announced they had received a combined level of $3 million in grant funding from the California Coastal Commission to study sea level rise and update their local coastal plans. Point Arena received its funding first and announced its findings in September of 2023. Previously, the Coastal Commission explained that the sea level has risen 7 to 8 inches globally in the last century. One of the goals of the various studies is to establish sea level baselines. The county's role is to study the entire coastline of Mendocino, while Fort Bragg is using their funding to focus on Noyo Harbor. Mendocino County Planning and Building Services Director Julia Krogh explained the process for using the funds from the initial grant.
The grant is awarded by the Coastal Commission. Then there's a very heavy administrative process. This includes preparing and executing the grant agreement with the Coastal Commission, preparing requests for proposals for consultants, and then scoring the received proposals, and then ultimately awarding a contract. We have to prepare that contract, send it through our routing process for the selected consultants, and then ultimately that has to go to our County Board of Supervisors to approve those contracts. The next step is that the technical studies are then prepared by the consultants, including there is stakeholder engagement prior to finalization of those studies. Then we move on to policy and code drafting and additional stakeholder engagement, then on to public hearings, with Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors. And then ultimately our final end goal for these grants is going to be submitting the Local Coastal Program Amendment application to the Coastal Commission for certification. And our target is December 2026 to have that be submitted.
Krogh then provided a status on the county's hiring of consultants.
We did open up our request for proposals, and we did three at the same time, starting September of 2023 and closing at the end of October. And that was for a coastal groundwater study consultant, a State Route 1 traffic highway capacity study, and a visual and archaeological resources consultant. So these are some of those technical studies that are required for us to be able to begin any level of policy drafting. Then our next round of requests for proposals, we opened up in November and closed those in December, and that's related to biological resources and habitats and natural resources consultant. We have awarded some contracts. On February 27th, our Board of Supervisors approved our contract agreements with three different consultants. So the first is for the Coastal Groundwater Study Consultant. Our State Route 1 Traffic Highway Capacity Study was awarded, and then our Visual and Archaeological Resources Consultant. And we have still outstanding that will require board approval is the Biological Resources and Habitats and Natural Resources Consultant. And we expect that that'll go in front of our board likely in the next month here. And then the last request for proposal that we have remaining to prepare underneath this Round 8 grant award is our CEQA compliance consultant, so California Environmental Quality Act. We anticipate that we will be preparing an environmental impact report, and so that is what we are expecting we will be soliciting a consultant for.
Finally, Krogh talked about the second grant, which is still in the administrative phase.
So let me just talk about our second grant award, which is our rolling grant award. This is for the sea level rise vulnerability assessment. And our grant agreement was just executed this January. And we have prepared the draft scope of work for the sea level rise vulnerability assessment request for proposal that we will need to send out. And that's currently under review with Coastal Commission staff. Now, this project is where we are working closely with Sarah McCormick and her team over at the City of Fort Bragg, because we do have complimentary grant awards as it relates to sea level rise work within our county.
Fort Bragg Special Projects Manager Sarah McCormick provided an update on the city's efforts and talked about information sharing.
Our Local Coastal Program Round 8 Grant Award, we have three deliverables here at the city. One of them was a community engagement plan. The second one is a planning document that's being called the Noyo Harbor Blue Economy Visioning, Resiliency, and Implementation Plan. And then the third deliverable is the application to the Coastal Commission for a Local Coastal Program Amendment to update our policies. We're working very closely with the county because, as you all know, the harbor is not within city limits. It's within our sphere of influence. And all the work that, all the findings that we're going to be coming up with, we're going to be sharing with the county so that they can use that information for their decision-making process and their own LCP update. The city has released, we've already released the community engagement plan, and we are in the process of meeting on a monthly basis as volunteer groups. And if you would like to participate in our volunteer outreach team, we invite you to do so. We're meeting on the fourth Saturday of the month from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Information about that can also be found on the project website. But this is basically an opportunity for our community to do a lot of peer-to-peer information exchange so that we can learn together. We're trying to figure out how can we support our harbor and our maritime culture to be part of a climate-ready infrastructure and a climate-ready workforce, and one where environmental stewardship and the economy are really working together. We're at a time right now where our ecosystems and our oceans are really fragile. We have a lot of issues with our kelp forests and the urchin barrens. Our fisheries are changing. Our working waterfront's really suffering. And we need to really work together as a community to find solutions to this.
Participants in the meeting expressed concerns about housing, groundwater studies, and the Gualala Town Plan, as well as the Mendocino Railway federal loan for improvements to their tracks and tunnel. An update on the Mendocino Railway loan and Coastal Commission action is available on the KZYX News website. You can watch the entire meeting at the grassrootsinstitute.org website. For KZYX News, I'm Michelle Blackwell.
And that's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lauren Schmidt, Sarah Reith, and Michelle Blackwell. KMUD News is online, you can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from KMUD Studio in Redway, I'm Ohelia Holland, Youth in Journalism intern, reporting for KMUD.